Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jaram.
And you're listening to The Coast.
To Coast.
Bio. Podcast.
Podcast.
Hey, hey, Hari, how are you?
Very fine. And you?
I'm doing quite well. It's, it seemed like we recorded this yesterday.
Exactly. Has spring finally hit you guys, or is it been like cold and, or did you get snow? Was it the Midwest or something got snow?
Yeah, I think the Midwest is in bad shape. We actually had a pretty good few days. Rained yesterday. Today, I think, was a nice day again. It's still not warm, but you're starting to see birds come back and things like that.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. And how was your week?
Week was spent recovering from a 24-hour synchrotron stretch, as always. Other than that, there's been a lot of work because the Gordon conferences and stuff are coming up.
Yeah.
So we are all ramping up to get our stuff ready to go and present, data and so on there. But yeah, it's been good. I mean, I think this is going to be a busy summer.
My summer is going to be fairly busy. I have travel coming up this week, which wasn't originally planned. And then, of course, there's a trip to Boston end of April. And, after that, I have no idea. I think I want to take a break for a while. But it's going to stay busy for the foreseeable future. But it's good busy, so I can't complain. Definitely work's been very interesting, and definitely the kind of people I'm talking to gets more and more interesting, and the problems that they're trying to solve. I keep getting calls from people I've worked with in the past in the life science industry who are interested mm-hmm. in running on AWS, which Amazon. Is so cool. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. Speaking of busy, I guess we have like a huge list of potential topics, right, for today?
Yeah, it's so big that I think we even left some out, which we didn't even talk about in the pre-show because, I have no idea whether we will be able to get to them. But let's start off with something nice, cool, and geeky. I think I'm not even sure if we've talked about this in the past because it might have been something that got the chopping block a couple of times. Because we had these few marathon episodes that just kept going on and on. But we all know about the Google Summer of Code program. And I remember you mentioning various potential opportunities. I've seen posts, tweets from, who's a Gentoo guy? The open source Gentoo crystallography fellow based out in Oregon.
Give me 2 seconds.
Yeah, I know his name. It's just escaping me. I even met him at OSCON last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it'll show up in the show notes if neither of us can remember. I mean, I remember seeing tweets from him.
I built my computer based on his recommendation.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, yeah. While you're figuring out what his name is, the Philo Informatics. Philo Informatics Summer of Code 2009. So they've been accepted as a mentoring program for the third time. I suspect Roderick Page is involved.
The name's Donnie Buchholz.
Yeah, actually. Sorry, Donnie Buchholz.
Yes.
Yeah,
Donnie.
Sorry.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. So anyway, the Philo Informatics Summer of Code has been accepted as a mentoring organization for the 2009 Google Summer of Code program. So they have a wiki page out, which we'll connect in the show notes, but they're talking about all the ideas they have for the Summer of Code, which includes things like semantic Philo informatic web services, GPU acceleration using OpenCL, Philo XML support in BioRuby, extending JALView alignment visualization tool, various things, BioPerl integration, protein 3D structure evolution. Very, very interesting set of topics, and it's always good to see life science topics being included in the Summer of Code. I think at one point of time, you had suggested that there was a shortage of life science topics in this year's Summer of Code proposals, or maybe
yeah, they were looking actually, and they actually polled just about every mailing list out there, the Bio Java, Bio Perl, Bio Python, you name it, and asking for people to suggest stuff so that, you know, to propose things that would be accepted. And I think, so if I'm not mistaken, the way the Google Summer of Code project works is they start off with inviting proposals. So, you know, teams kind of say, or people put up things that they think would need improving, or organizations make a pitch saying, we'd like to have Google pay for people to work on things in under our umbrella. So the mentoring organizations make a pitch, then they are picked, correct? And now is the second stage, wherein the mentoring organizations now are putting their list of projects and things that they can mentor. And it's up for people to kind of review those proposals. And then I guess somebody or somehow they pick the actual things that get worked on during the summer, right?
Yeah, I think that's kind of how it works. And I think there have been some very phenomenally, you know, cool projects in the Google Summer of Code over the years. It's not just a fun hackathon. You actually get workable, usable software at the end of it.
Oh, in fact, yeah, just about everybody, right? Like Apache, you know, FFmpeg, you know, I think I heard about like some, what's it, ZFS, you know, a bunch of like really high level projects use summer talent. And I think it's more like as a teaching thing as well, but it's been quite impressive. I think they also started sponsoring Floss Weekly, right? The most recent episode of Floss Weekly was sponsored by the Google Summer of Code. So it looks like they're really reaching out to everybody and, you know, to really popularize this even more.
Yeah, and, not that
this list is
not that they need much popularization.
I know.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. But yeah, this list is really cool, and I think it's going to see, you know, an explosion of biological projects, you know, getting accepted, and it'll be nice to see what comes out of this summer. But I don't know. I need to find out more about how you kind of. I'm not sure that you actually vote on these, but, you know, at least kind of follow what's going on. I'm sure they have repositories that you can link to and so on.
Yeah.
That we need to figure out.
Come to think of it, I mean, there's no... It would be great to have the structural biology community. I mean, I think that's kind of what... I think the interest Donnie had was from the Gen 2 side, not from the structural biology side, if I understand correctly. But it would be great to have the structural biology community sort of form a group and participate in this.
Yeah, I wonder if PyMOL's on there. Actually, I'm going to look. But I think the problem with a lot of stuff, right, is that our most of our code bases are fairly kind of, they come out from one lab.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not like, there's not that much collaborate. I mean, you have the CCP4 and crystallography.
Yeah, actually,
but even that's like five labs.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm looking at the whole thing.
Difficult.
The current mentoring organizations are, you know, I'll just mention some names, and I wish they had the kind of stuff that they did along with that. But it's phenomenal. The mentoring organizations include XWiki, XF.org, which is library software, WordPress, the Wine Project, Wikimedia. I'm just going up, Turbo Gears, Tickle Community Association, Subversion, Sunlight Foundation, which is really cool, which is like open source government stuff. Scilab, Samba, R Foundation for Statistical Computing. So the R Project is a mentoring organization.
Yeah.
I think that's something that the community could jump into, because I think R is fundamentally part of bioinformatics. So actually that's one area where I think there's lots of contributions. Possible. The Fedora Project and JBoss.org, so Red Hat, Ruby on Rails, Python Software Foundation.
Yeah, the Python Software Foundation is big. Yeah,
yeah, the Ptolemy Project, Plone, PHP, Oregon State University Open Source Lab. This could be Donnie's, because I think that's where he is. OpenSSH, OpenStreetMap, Natural... There's some other interesting one. NetBSD, Nescent, which is what we were talking about just now.
Yeah, Nescent's the bio part, yeah.
Yeah, NCSA, Mozilla Project, Mono Project, Mifos, You mentioned FFmpeg, GNU Project, Joomla, KDE, mm-hmm. Linux Foundation, LLVM.
Just about anybody yeah. who's somebody in yeah. open source is on there, right? Yeah.
LLVM compiler infrastructure, which you, I think, put up on our...
Yeah, we have a story coming up, yeah.
Yeah, Haskell, Haiku, Hackistat. I think Hackistat I heard on Floss once. Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's a lot. And so Eclipse Foundation, DSpace, Drupal, Django, MySQL... Yeah, the Creative Commons. I think what we really need is a group of structural biology people to come together and do
something
interesting.
It's not
going to
happen for a while.
I know that, but yeah. It would be nice.
And I don't know. I think it's not like the problems in structural biology are code-related, right? I mean, most of it is...
I don't know. I was having this very interesting conversation last week where somebody was talking about the evolution of code in science. It says a lot of the codes that we use today still have their origins in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. right? When a lot of them came up. And it was basically those codes were written by scientists who didn't really know how to write software.
Almost all of it is written by scientists
and
who...
So we were talking about how terrible these codes are and how a lot of his job as a consultant is basically spent trying to work around the limitations of all the code that people want to deploy on HPC clusters and so on, when the codes weren't meant to run on anything more than one processor, properly, or some big SMP box. So I think there's room for some interesting software
projects. Oh, there's a lot of room, but whether it'll happen is what I guess I'm questioning more. I mean, there's infinite room. Just you look at any... code that came up from like one or two labs which have been around for like 20 years, it's still stuck in a very old way of coding things, and it's not very efficient. But things are changing, so maybe in another few years we'll have a lot of the structural biologists would get on board too. Like things like, I think Qt and PyMol are exceptions, right? In that they are built, using version control, and they're out there and you can see everything day by day pretty much. But almost everything else I can think of is not built that way. So at least in crystallography space.
And actually, I remember when PyMol came around, a lot of why it was so popular was A, it was open source. Mm-hmm. B, the quality was exceptionally good. I mean, it was way better than anything else out there. And it was free. The best stuff out there at the time was really expensive. And and you could contribute to the code. It was using Python, which at that time was somewhat novel. All the visualization suites we had were these rich, the Accelerus Insight
types. Most of them were written in C.
TCL-based ones, which VMD was at the time. So it was definitely amazing. Or, you had stuff like Swiss 3DB Viewer, which I never liked. It was good for what it did, but it was definitely not super good. So it'll be interesting to see in the future what kind of projects make it. And, good luck to the Nescent people. They're the only true bio people in the entire...
And I put my personal vote for JALView's improvement track, because I think JALView is one of the best pieces of bioinformatics software that's out there. It's amazing.
Yeah, I definitely think JALView gets my support as well. I'm actually very interested in seeing some of the web-based stuff. For example, they have sort of stuff to try and build some kind of JavaScript front ends to a lot of the back-end stuff, and it'll be interesting to see how they do it. My favorite part of this is moderate project if student has only web development experience with Java. Moderate hard project if student has only Perl experience. So easy project if Java GUI development experience and GWT experience. So it's interesting stuff, definitely.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was story number one. The second thing we wanted to talk about, which I put up there, and I only put up two of the links. There's a whole host of links. You've been busy, so you haven't seen the library kerfuffle on FriendFeed, have you?
No, not at all. Yeah, I tried starting to read it, but there's such a long thread that I said I'll just leave it to you.
Yeah, and I'm not going to go into the specifics. I'll just talk about some of the genesis. It came with Peter Murray Rust, who, you know Peter Murray Rust at all?
Yeah, well, I know who he is. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I've had the pleasure of meeting him a few times. Yeah, but Peter Murray Rust had stopped blogging for a while. He just disappeared. And then he came back recently, and he's been blogging about a number of things. But one of the things he's been talking about is libraries of the future. And I guess he hit a nerve because on FriendFeed, there's a lot of librarians and library technology people. And they got really mad with him. At least the impression I got was they got really mad with him. And yeah, so, you know, there was all kinds of controversy where librarians were not happy with what Peter had to say and so on and so forth. But I guess it boils down to this fact that there's a conference going on called Join the Librarians of the Future Debate. So there's a debate on librarians of the future. And Peter Murray Rust sort of used FriendFeed and so on to sort of set the table and do his pre-event discussions and get feedback. He's really good at that. And he ended up concluding that, quote, and I quote here, "I am left with the overwhelming impression that the community is now past caring about the future of the library." So basically, he's expressed serious concern at the apathy he senses amongst university librarians in their failure to engage with the issues that will seriously affect them as we advance into the digital age. I should preface, so, you know, what I wanted to discuss today was this question, you know, the role of libraries and the intersection between libraries and science. You know, growing back in grad school and before, we definitely spent a lot of time in the library, finding papers and going through journals. This was pre-web, you know, both of us, a lot of our heavy-duty stuff predates the web, or at least the web being, predates Google being around, you know.
Predates, you know, full-time access using, I think we finished our masters around the time Mozilla came out.
Mosaic came around while Mosaic came out while we were still around the time we were in IIT. For the longest time there, we were still using Lynx. Netscape came out towards the end. When I came to the US, you know, using AltaVista and Lycos, but there's nothing really good out there. You still had to go to the library, look up there. You know, you wanted a paper, you went in there, looked it up in there. Lookup tables or whatever.
Yeah, and most of my undergrad days were spent traveling all the way down to the British Council Library, borrowing the CD-ROM of PubMed, silver platter. I forget who the service was, but somebody would put Medline. That's what it was called, Medline Abstract Service. And then anyway, so yeah. But sorry, go ahead.
I was such a chemist then. It was all chemical abstracts.
I was trying to get into biology. So, yeah. Oh, and the chemical abstracts. Well, the reason I didn't mention that is even now it's stupid to go look for the chemical abstracts. I mean, if you want to do a study in contrast, that would be the last example I would come up with, you know.
Quite honestly, anyway. I canceled my ACS membership because I had had enough. Yeah, and I canceled it after being a member for over 12 years. So
I stopped.
I was done.
I guess I've never been wealthy enough. I've never been in an institution that had after IIT. Actually, we never had the chemical abstracts. Well, maybe not. But anyway, never mind.
But anyway, the thing I wanted to talk to you about is you're still in a university. You're still doing research as opposed to me. What is your take on the relationship between researchers, scientists, and librarians, and your take on this whole field?
I think the librarians, I mean, as I'm sure Peter Murray has probably mentioned in his post, I haven't read the post, but they are generally stuck in some era when they were very important, and they haven't, it seems like they haven't really marched ahead with the times. And especially with regards to libraries and, you know, the whole thing about information technology, I mean, most of these librarians were librarians when there was no field like information technology. So most institutions don't really get their act together, and they have two different divisions. So, you know, the library is its own division, and then you have IT. And like, for example, at Baylor, you know, we couldn't really access journals from out off campus. It was really stupid, you know, like something as simple as a proxy was unheard of, which was annoying. And I'm sure that is because the librarians did not, or the librarians did not realize they had to communicate with IT to make sure that people could access journals that they're paying thousands and thousands and whatever, tens of thousands of dollars for off campus. The point is they don't, I mean, I guess they still definitely have a place, but their place is kind of shifted away from where they were. And librarians should teach people how to leverage technology to do the same things that people would go to a library for before. Like, for example, you know, like something like PubMed, right? I mean, there's a million ways to query PubMed, which most people don't know about. And of course, you know, you could learn it on the web, but it's really cool if your librarian, whose specialty is like searching for information, tells you, all right, here's the 50,000 ways you can like perform your search more effectively. I mean, these are skills that are learned, and you find that most librarians still, you know, just are not waking up to the fact that they still are relevant, and they just have to adapt their relevance to our new ways of doing searches, our new ways of looking at literature, and so on. So in a way, I think I really like the Brandeis Library, actually. And the reason for that is, compared to the medical, you know, the Baylor College of Medicine, the Medical Center Library, which is very technology agnostic, I mean, technology phobic, here they actually merged the libraries in with this thing called LTS. I think it's called Learning Technology Services. So even IT is part of that. And it was a great thing because now we have, I mean, we have things like Safari Online. I've spoken to, you know, like computer science master's students at Brandeis who have no idea that we have access to all of O'Reilly's, you know, Safari books online. And I think that's where librarians really need to kind of like get their act together and start popularizing the new ways. You know, it doesn't mean that if you don't physically go to a library and lift a book off a shelf, a librarian is irrelevant. You know, I think all libraries should really popularize, you know, the tools that are out there that they used to be custodians of. And, you know, so that's some way that they can really contribute. In this regard, you know, the Virginia Tech, I think, was it Virginia Tech? Well, I'm not sure. There's this one library site that I remember going to. It is in Virginia, but I'm not sure which of the Virginia universities. They had a set of like 5 to 6, you know, pages of screencasts which tell you how to search for information more effectively on the web. And I think they were produced by the library itself. Now, you know, I would argue if you have resources like that, it really makes the library more relevant, because now I'm more likely to go to the library to ask somebody out there saying, you know, oh, I need to find this information. I don't really know how to. And even if the librarian or the library person walks you over to the computer and teaches you, I think that's immense value. And, you know, never mind the fact that they don't really have any stacks behind there. You know, it could be like a room with like 10 computers and that's the library. But anyway, that's my take on. I think some institutions get it very well and most don't. And I think that's probably why like Peter Murray Russ probably annoyed a lot of people, because most of the people are in the part where they just don't get it. And they're a little slighted at the fact that how can you say we are irrelevant, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm continuing to read these threads, and Christina Pekas actually had a nice blog post, which I should probably put up in the show notes, about what a digital librarian does. But I still wonder, I mean, and I say this as somebody who loves, who has a great respect for library science. Mm-hmm. I think library science, people like Richard Ackerman are really smart at thinking about services and providing services to people, looking at libraries as a service and thinking about it from the IT services point of view. You have people in the like DSpace and Fedora Commons building up digital curation, digital content management, digital repository systems, and so on. The folks at Talis who have done so much for semantic web stuff and open data licensing. And essentially, they're a library company and building library content management systems. I think the challenge I see, and as a scientist, I used to interact with librarians early on because you needed to find a journal in the stack. Or mm-hmm. you needed to say, hey, do we have a subscription to that? Today, that's mm-hmm. not necessarily true. I am convinced that more and more we'll have more open journals, right? more and more journal content will be easily available. So, you know, inherently, the ability of today's graduate student, today's scientist, to find information is way different from what it was 10 years ago. It's basically a Google search away. I think the challenge of the librarians, the challenge librarians face, so let's see what happens when the Kindle comes out and becomes a library tool. When all you need to do to get a book to read is essentially hit a dial a number, essentially hit some link, and voila, you have a book rental for a week. I mean, Kindle, whatever. Some e-book reader.
E-book reader.
You essentially, the physical library will cease to exist in 25, you know, at some point of time, completely.
I don't think so, actually. I just think it'll be... Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
I mean, it won't completely disappear, but already... Mm-hmm. I mean, we are members of both the Seattle Public Library and the King County Public Library. The only mm-hmm. reason we became members of the Seattle Public Library was because we could access to Safari. From home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah? So that, I mean, I think, and that's probably what, you know, libraries will do a lot of times is allow people to, or serve as a gateway to allow people to access, you know, mostly electronic resources, so, and maybe some other, you know.
So stuff. let me rephrase. The libraries will have two roles. One is custodians of information, which mm-hmm. I think is their most important role.
Mm-hmm.
This is archived text, archived material, finding rare stuff, helping people find things that they cannot find on Google, which is...
Yeah, I think is more important, being custodians of information, you know, because in a way, I think, like, being a custodian of information is something left to, like, other people, but helping people find things, I think that's really, really... I guess that's what a custodian does. Anyway,
yeah.
Never mind.
So,
Sorry, go ahead.
So actually, and this helping really find things. Back in the day, we needed help finding things. We don't need that help anymore.
Some of us don't, but a lot of people, I'm serious, like helping, there is a lot libraries can do to make things easier to find.
Exactly.
You know,
agreed.
Like, I mean, Google, right? I mean, yeah, if you don't see it in the first two pages of Google, what do? If you don't even know the jargon or whatever associated with what you probably are looking for, right? I mean, I think that's where the librarians come in and people who are in the library, right, come in.
But
if
you're a scientist in a particular field, you will know that jargon. I think generally, yes. But specifically for a research area, you know what the big journals in your field are. You know how to find stuff related to crystallography more than most librarians would. Agreed.
Right, but, you know, I don't know, my example, right, where if you look at most of computer science master's students at Brandeis, right,
yeah.
Or my sample size is an N of 3,
yeah.
They didn't know that Brandeis had a subscription to Safari Online, you know, and I think that means somebody didn't do their job right,
yeah.
And I would blame the librarians, you know, they are paying for the service, they should have probably, you know, I don't know, held like a slit in a pamphlet at every class saying, by the way, now you can, you know, get almost every book that's out there from the O'Reilly, you know, platform for free because you're, you know, in the thanks to our library over here.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. No, I think so. If you look at it two ways, there's custodians of information and connectors to information. I think those
they need to do
two
both
things
of that,
that
you know?
I think are there. Yeah.
Huh?
It's going to be interesting to see how it evolves because if I look at the list that Christina Pikas talks about, which is selecting information. Librarians touch every bit of this by selecting information sources, getting things customers need, deselecting if they tend to be too offsite. There's a whole management side of things, which I think is critical.
Yeah.
And
correct. Yeah.
You need people to do that. Mm-hmm. Selecting, finding tools like research databases. I think as more and more as you get these open repositories and open databases, that I think a lot of librarians essentially need to be decentralized. I think one of the problems, and I think this speaks to what you were saying, librarians are very focused. There's a Baylor library, there's this library, as opposed to a more generic, general,
mm-hmm.
federated right. library system, which is, I think, what the web has become over the last 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And it really needs to be. I think they do a really good job with managing licenses, negotiating access to them. But again, as more and more of these barriers go away, it is that cataloging, it is that connecting people to information services, building resource portals that are relevant to you know, sort of hyper-specific or something
like
that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's really well put, because this whole resource portal thing, right? Like, brand, like again, to give you an example of Brandeis. Brandeis launched this thing that came out of this LTS, you know, it's not a library, not an IT kind of thing, called Brandeis Scholar, you know, like built off Google Scholar. And it's cool because it actually searches across all the databases that the library subscribe to and Google. And if you, you know, very often you'll find a book on Google Scholar, and the Brandeis Library has kind of mashed it up with books at the Brandeis Library, which also are related to the one on Google Scholar. So you'll get three books on Google Scholar, and you'll get like eight or nine books at Brandeis Library.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm sitting like two floors up, I'd rather just run down there and grab one of those books and just look at it. And I think that's, you know, that's something, right? This was an information portal put together by the library.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the librarians had a lot to do with it, because they are the ones who know their holdings. They are the ones who know their subscriptions. And they I'm sure, worked with the IT people to put together this portal. So, yeah, that's a brilliant
point. And I think what librarians need to know, I think this is part of Peter Murray Rust's point, is they need to work with the researchers and find out what the researchers need. As you know, I look at librarians as back-end technology today. You know, this whole thing of building up infrastructure to get information, you know, there's the general infrastructure, which is Google. But you have very specific infrastructure that helps in a scholarly situation. And making that part easy, along with that custodian of information part, rare manuscripts and so on and so forth, they need to be doing that. But they also need to be aware of the fact and ready to move with the times as more and more and more of this gets digital. As more and more, you know, in certain fields, all the information of importance will be in the last 20 years, meaning it'll all be available digitally. It'll all be
And in fact,
it'll
that's
all be
already
indexed.
Happening, right? Yeah. There's so many studies that say that citation histories are getting shallower and shallower. You know, you only go back to the last 2 or 3 years. So, yeah.
So, it's very interesting. It's fascinating to see how this is going to evolve, man. And I know a lot of librarians online, John and Christina, and Richard's not a librarian; he's a library technologist. But I think I'll probably end up. I'm interacting with a lot of libraries these days, and it's going to be interesting to see. And I need to figure out for myself, as I start working with these people a little more, as in what the exact role of libraries are going forward. I'm trying to understand how we can work with what kind of technology resources they need. I definitely think Richard has the right track, because he always thinks about it from a service-based architecture standpoint. And libraries in the end provide a service.
Correct.
Most university library services are arcane, to say the least. And it's going to vary from university to university. Some are better than others. And I agree with something that somebody said in Christina's blog post. A lot of the work they've done is behind the scenes and it gets missed. But on the other hand, you know, as Duncan Hull asked in that thread, so what have libraries, technologists, you know, what have librarians done in the last 20 years? Because I never interact with anyone. So it's going to be interesting. And I don't think this debate is over by any standards.
Yeah.
And
it's a very interesting debate, actually. Cool.
Yeah, and we are already 35 minutes into the podcast. So,
oh my goodness!
Yeah,
and
so,
that was like topic two of.
And we still have our more fun, most fun topic, which is this beautiful paper written by Alan Halevy, Peter Norvig, and Fernando Pereira at Google, where they talk about the unreasonable effectiveness of data. Have you had the chance to read this paper yet?
Yeah, I did actually.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very nice call to having more data as a solution to understanding complexity and how you don't have to wait for elegant models, right, to emerge from shallow pools of data. You'd rather have huge pools of data and have, you know, complex, you know, models that try to describe those huge pools.
Yeah.
Is that like a good gist? Or?
Yeah. In a sense, they also say that it's unfortunate that the semantic web and semantic interpretation both have the word semantic in them. Because one of the big things that galls me all the time is that the semantic web and natural language processing get lumped together. And they're completely different things. The semantic web is a technology.
Right.
It is a way for making machines talk to each other. While semantic interpretation is trying to get meaning from text. Okay. And what they're basically saying is the stuff we're doing in the semantic interpretation space is not required. We are trying to add complexity to shallow pools of data. And essentially what they're saying is that you should have enough information that it becomes statistically significant once you start finding patterns in it.
Right.
Yeah. So
it's important to get a lot of information and not perhaps, I mean, that's a very important too, instead of trying to fit your semantic patterns to the shallow pools right now. It's funny, but okay, sorry.
No, go ahead. No, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was saying, as I was reading this, right, I agree with a lot of this, but when you extend this principle outside, I don't know, you know, this comes back to my whole shtick against big science. You know, a lot of genomics uses the same argument, right? If it's very complex, let's just get a lot of data, you know. But I still do not think this argument can be extended to a lot of that other stuff. Like, you cannot say that we don't really understand it well, so let's just get more and more data. I don't think that works for other things. But
I don't think it is generalizable completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I actually like the idea of models for explaining scientific fact.
Correct.
In fact, that's the argument. Yeah, that's the argument Chris Anderson made. But you cannot generalize this to everything. In fact, for science, I think the model part is because you don't have a shallow pool of data. And and very often the data you need to collect are driven by the models that you generate. Because it is hypothesis driven. It never goes away. Even genomics, I think you're right. One of the problems with the genomics world is we tend to forget about hypothesis and we're too busy producing data. And the fact that we need to figure out what this data means gets lost. I will argue that we have learned a lot from the data, and basically what we've learned is we don't know anything. Time we think we figured out how things work, we collect data which tells us, you got that part wrong. Genes are not enough, kind of thing. And I think this whole, everybody for a while was very, was hoping that basically genes would be able to explain everything. And it's very, and it would be a very convenient solution, but unfortunately it's not that.
Sadly, we never got there.
Well, actually, I think it's a good thing that we aren't there yet, because then it would become very convenient to put everything in these little baskets and be very happy that,
But, you know, you have to, I'm always amazed at our collective naivete, right? I mean, 15 years back or 20 years back, we really did think that sequencing the entire human genome would probably get us a lot further than where we are now, you know? But then again, I mean, it's just like how we all thought we'd be in flying cars or something by now, I guess.
Yeah, to some extent, their philosophy is now go out and gather some data and see what it can do. Which is great, but at some point of time, you have to start trying to figure out how you want to query that data. Because depending on how you're querying it, you get different information out. You can't, science just does not say, oh, here it is, and this is the answer. That's not how you get there. And I agree completely. Generalizing this to science would be a big mistake. The way I look at it, this paper basically says that NLP is almost a dead field.
Natural language processing, right?
Yeah, it's almost a dead field. And I met people who used to do NLP and have moved away from it to more data processing and data analytics. And that would suggest that that's definitely true. Basically what they're saying is choose a representation that can use unsupervised learning on unlabeled data, which is so much more plentiful than labeled data. But scientific data is labeled. If you cannot label it, then you're missing out.
Shouldn't be gathering it in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Then all you're doing is creating noise. But it was definitely an interesting read from just a purely, it's a very well written paper. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
If I can add something from it, which is completely unrelated to the fact, he says, where's it gone? It sort of reminds you of beautiful physics is. They talk about how physics can be neatly explained with things like F is equal to ma and E is equal to mc squared. And I was just reminded how amazing it is that you can represent something as important as force, as mass into acceleration, and be done with it. But it took a long time to figure it out. But it is exact. I wish biology was like that, but it isn't.
It's
I think that's always why I've liked the always had a soft spot for physics, and why I wish we could explain everything biological with physical models.
Eventually.
Yeah, we will get there. I mean, eventually we have to. I don't think we need to do it for everything. I actually wrote a blog post on that recently where, you know, you have these structure, you know, protein simulation, protein folding guys trying to explain everything and trying to come up with accurate measures for everything. And like, don't try and solve every problem. Try and solve the problems that you can't address any other way. You know, because between other computational methods, informatics, and experiment, there's certain things that you don't need to worry about. People will find answers for them and focus on the other stuff. So that was it for that topic. I guess we can actually skip that open access association thing. And let's talk about Toby.
This is the fun part, I guess.
Yeah.
So so the TOB index, I heard about this on the Java Posse podcast, actually. And I guess for March 2009, the TOB programming community index, which comes out, I guess, twice a year or at least once a year, basically it gives you an indication of the quote-unquote popularity of programming languages. And, the index is updated once a month. So it comes out every month. And the ratings are based on the number of skilled engineers worldwide, courses, and third-party vendors. So it's kind of a very kind of industry-centric metric. So it's not the total lines of code or, you know, it's just based on, job ads and, you know, courses and vendors and so on. And also keyword searches on popular search engines like Google, MSN, Yahoo, so on and so forth. So it's a kind of a cool index because it allows you to track, whether your programming skills are still up to date or more like whether you're still working on things that the rest of the world thinks is hot. So for March 2009, the ratings are pretty the way they have been for a while, which is that the position one is still Java. And this tells you, of course, job market, i.e. a lot of enterprise development is in Java nowadays.
Yeah.
Position two actually is C. And position three is C++. And position four is PHP, which is very surprising.
Actually, it's not. I would expect the PHP to be higher.
Right.
I'm surprised it's that low.
I don't know. I guess, there's so much web development taking place. And
You forget, WordPress is PHP, movable type is PHP.
Right, exactly.
Content management systems are PHP.
And position five. And so they also tell you how it has moved. It's kind of like a stock ticker up or down. Yeah. And at position five, Visual Basic is back on there. I wonder how.
It's down twice, right?
Yeah, it's been down. And number six is my personal favorite. Python's on there. Beating C#, JavaScript, Perl, Delphi, and Ruby, which is quite surprising.
Actually, no. Because Ruby is the youngest of the lot.
Yeah, youngest. So in terms of, job uptake and tutorial uptake and so on, that's probably
Perl not that much contribution. It's kind of sad to see Perl fall so much.
I don't know. Anyway.
Sentimental reasons.
Python convert now that I just... And the fact that Perl, what's it, 6, right? Perl 6 is just seems to be lost in some wilderness. You know, even like on the Floss Weekly, even people like Randall Schwartz is now more... Squeak and...
Small talk.
Small talk guy. So I just think like... Well, anyway, I wrote more Perl than I have ever written anything else right now.
Likewise.
But if you ask me to do anything now, I'd just jump right to Python because I could never remember Perl syntax.
Yeah.
But Python syntax seems more Java-like. So
it's
kind of a cool index. And Logo is on there. It has like a 22 position rise. No, 8 position rise. And surprising ones are Lua, is, well, it's kind of had a down.
I mean, SaaS is up in the top 20.
Yeah, I know. It's quite, I guess there's a lot of financial institutions, right?
Yeah,
that probably
using SaaS.
Use a lot of, I didn't know about this index, and it is cool to kind of come across it and see the languages that I care about kind of in the top 10 at least.
Yeah, Haskell is in 34, Scala is 35, Erlang is 31. Yeah.
Exactly.
Fortran is still 27. Yeah. No, what was
Lab
actually...
LabVIEW?
Yeah, LabVIEW is actually cool. I've played with it a little bit. What's interesting, lower down the page, there's sort of a 2004 to 2009 trend.
Right.
And you have Java staying one throughout. It was one in 2004.
Correct.
C is not changed. C++ has not changed, although their usage has all gone down.
PHP hasn't changed. Well, no, PHP's gone up. In 2009.
Visual Basic has stayed flat. Python's gone up. C# stayed flat. JavaScript has stayed flat. Perl has gone down a lot. Delphi has stayed flat. And of course, Ruby has come from nowhere.
Yeah. Like 11 points up compared to 2004.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting. Definitely an interesting find. I was not aware of TOB at all. Sort of related to that, since on the Python side, is you link to this thing called Unladen Swallow, which is the coolest name I've ever seen for anything.
It is. Unladen Swallow is basically three engineers, I guess, most of whom who are at Google. All three of whom are at Google, who decided that's Colin Winter, Jeffrey Yaskin, and Thomas Wouters. So they decided to have a branch. It's not a fork. It's just a branch of CPython. And the goals of this project, which was actually announced at the Languages and VM sub-conference, which is part of PyCon 2009, and anyway, the goals of Unladen Swallow is to produce a version of Python that's at least 5 times faster than CPython. And of course, Python application performance should be stable, maintain source level compatibility with CPython applications, maintain source level compatibility with the modules, so on and so forth. So yeah, it seems like they're trying to adopt this, what's it called, LLVM. It's kind of this VM technology and just-in-time compiling and, you know, kind of, I think along the lines of what Sun's Hotspot does for Java, to speed things up a lot more over CPython. And the idea is to have this kind of be worked on as kind of a branch of the main Python, and as and when optimizations are proven, they will be incorporated into CPython. And of course, there is a concern because apparently the LLVM or technology doesn't work very well on Windows. But it's a cool project, and it seems like there's a lot of buzz now about doing this. And of course, I mean, I can imagine how, like Google with App Engine and so on, there's really a lot of Python out there. And this project, Michael Fjord actually talked about it on his Twitter feed, saying Unladen Swallow is ready to, you know, kind of get out there. So it's a cool project that should make Python a lot faster. And one of the things they're actually working on is to have Python really go well, or prepare Python for the you know, the existence of all these multi-core processors and so on. The threading models in Python are pretty advanced, but it's still not as good as it can be, given that soon we'll be having, you know, like 18 to 20 cores at least in all our machines. And this is kind of a preemptive strike on making Python ready for all that. And it's a great project. I mean, I'm going to be checking it out from time to time. I guess you can already kind of download it and compile it and give it a go. So it's neat.
Yeah, definitely. And the reason Unladen Swallow is kind of interesting right now is John Odell had a tweet yesterday from FooCamp East, where apparently somebody asked Wolfram Alpha the speed of an Unladen Swallow, and it gave you the speed of an Unladen Swallow.
Really?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It's formal knowledge, right? It can do it.
I know, yeah, exactly. This you mean they have a database somewhere that tells
no,
you?
No, it's computing it, right? Yeah, but it's based on curated data. But it's,
it's probably it's, weight of a bird divided by average airspeed, wingspan,
something like that. Goodness. Yeah, so it's a computed result. Yeah, it's kind of cool though. It gives you the answer. Google gives you a page with the answer.
Right.
So, sort of in the same, it's almost like having multiple links of the week today. Because I wanted to point out to two other geeky things, which we actually didn't talk about before the show, but I'll add them in anyway. Because one is that Matt Wood and company have organized something called Active Research, a very special evening of science, technology, Ruby, and Rails at RailsConf. Basically, they have a set of lightning talks, 7-minute lightning talks, bring slides, code, demos, host a panel, just chat about your latest Ruby and Rails projects. And it's all for science and research folks. Over there, so they have at least two guests there. One is Galaxy Zeus, Arfon, Community Science on Rails, and the other one is Lars Jorgensen, which says why Bill Gates loves Rails. He's from the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. So should be interesting, almost makes me want to go to RailsConf. And the other one that's interesting is that Paolo Nguyen has started a Ruby blog.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. And I really liked his Python blog. And he said he's kind of wanting to learn new tricks now and decided to get on the Ruby bandwagon. So, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think he was trying out Django and Rails, and he liked Rails better. So he tried to, I think what took him towards the Ruby side. But I am going to follow this one very closely because I really like his Python blog. With that Ruby part in, do you have a link for the week, or have you already talked about some cool links today?
I think we probably have a fair share of cool links, but if you have a link of the week, go for it.
I actually do. It's a site that I think Bora or somebody put up on FriendFeed. It's called thesciencebehindit.net. It's basically a site where if you have a news story where the journalist has written about a biological or medical research article, this is the place to get a link straight to the original article. So if you have a story on the BBC, it only works for the BBC and Reuters right now. You take that article, which talks about a scientific discovery, put it in the search engine for this, and it will link. You put the BBC article there and link to the actual paper, which they are using for that article. Because very often...
Yeah, I checked it out. That's pretty nice, yeah.
Yeah.
I wish the page was a little more appealing. But then again, it's a cool...
It's one guy.
Yeah, I know.
Can't blame him. But yeah, it's interesting. It's a very cool idea. I really like the idea.
Awesome. So cool. All right. If my link of the week will be... Jesse Noller's blog, which mostly talks about what's going to be coming up in Unladen Swallow and other projects. So there you go. I mean, I'm kind of riding off the back of our last article. But anyway, yeah, that's my link of the week. It's jessenoller.com.
Excellent.
And it's, again, a Python-centric blog. But maybe one day I'll get off my Python kick. But for now...
No, stay on it. It's cool. Yeah. And it was an interesting podcast today. Again, a lot of interesting topics, a heated discussion on libraries and Google code, I guess, was what we talked about for a long time today. I guess I'll chat with you next week.
Hey, and don't forget the FriendFeed room, right?
Yeah, right. So in addition to the fact that you can download this on iTunes and you can send us... suggestions either via email at hurry@bioscreencast.com or by tagging things as 4:C2CBio on Delicious. I set up a friend feed room called Coast to Coast Bio. I'll have the link in the show notes which our Delicious feed goes there because not everybody's on Delicious. All the episodes go there, but it's also a great place for actually discussing. If you put up a link there and you want to have a discussion on that link, or if you want to put up your own links directly in friend feed, since so many of our listeners do hang around there, do join up. I'm looking forward to seeing people in that room and discussion over there.
Awesome. All right. Cool. So this has been probably the longest episode so far, or pretty close?
Close. I don't think it's the longest yet. Anyway, it's getting to be the longest, so talk to you next week.
Okay, same here. Bye.
Bye-bye.